almost 20 Palestinians, including women and children, and injured dozens. According to local sources, Israeli forces targeted a group of people in Beit Lahia in northern Gaza, killing 3 citizens. Earlier on Wednesday, at least 15 civilians, including women and children, were killed and many others wounded in the bombing of a clinic run by the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza. On the whole, almost 80 Gazans were killed in Israel's strikes on Wednesday. Gaza officials say nearly 1,700 civilians have been killed and around 2,600 injured since Israel's onslaught resumed in March. The death toll from the regime's genocide now tops 50,400, with over 114,600 others injured. Our Gaza correspondent Moti Abu Musabeh joined us earlier with the latest updates on Israel's unrelenting attacks across the blockaded territory. Let's take a listen.
At least 7 essential squares were demanded completely and fully to be evacuated from the Palestinian people. And we understand clearly that this is a prelude to conduct another ground offensive targeting the northern part of Gaza. In the meantime, those evacuation orders were architected in order to add more suffering for the Palestinian people, who are still suffering severely on the ground as a result of those repetitive displacements and the ongoing and non-stop Israeli brutal attacks that are still carried out day and night, left and center, in all areas of Gaza. And in this regard, we are talking about more than 77 Palestinian civilians have been slaughtered since dawn hours till this moment, in light of those ongoing and ceaseless Israeli airstrikes and attacks. And the fish attack took place a short while ago in Al-Manshiya Street in Beit Lahia City, claiming the lives of 3 Palestinian civilians. In the meantime, the Israeli warplanes carried out several brutal airstrikes targeting multiple residential buildings, particularly in Khan Yunis City, whereas at least 2 residential buildings were targeted and pounded by the Israeli warplanes in less than an hour ago. And even here, when it comes to the central area of Gaza Strip, the Israeli attacks are still ongoing till this moment. We are talking about more artillery shelling targeting the northern part of Nusrat refugee camp. And the suffering of the Palestinian people is still exacerbating severely on the ground here due to the severe shortage of the basic humanitarian essentials and needs. The Israeli regime is still shutting down all Gaza crossings, preventing the entry of those humanitarian necessities.
The UN Human Rights Council has passed a resolution condemning Israel's renewed onslaught on Gaza. The council also demanded the regime prevent genocide and lift its illegal blockade on the territory. The resolution, which was put forward by most members of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, was adopted with an overwhelming majority. It voiced grave concern at statements by Israeli officials that amount to incitement to genocide. The resolution demanded unimpeded humanitarian aid and the restoration of basic necessities in Gaza. It also slammed the use of starvation of civilians as a weapon of war. The resolution called on all nations to halt arms sales to Israel and take immediate action to prevent the forcible transfer of Palestinians from Gaza. The text also called on the UN General Assembly to set up a new investigative team to prepare prosecutions for major international crimes committed in the war on Gaza. Various Palestinian cities and refugee camps across the occupied West Bank continue to be the target of violent raids by Israeli forces and settlers. In one of their latest raids, Israeli forces fatally shot a 15-year-old Palestinian boy in the town of Silat al-Harithiya, west of Jenin. The boy was shot in the chest after the regime's forces stormed the town with armored vehicles and unleashed heavy gunfire on the residents. According to the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, dozens more were injured in the raid. The new fatality brings to 35 the number of Palestinians killed in the Jenin governorate since Israel's operations began there. Tolkien was also subjected to Israeli forces' attacks for the 66th straight day. The regime's forces fired tear gas and sound bombs, set up roadblocks, and abducted civilians trying to return home. At least 13 Palestinians, including a child and 2 women, have been killed there. Thousands of others have been displaced, with their homes turned into military outposts. Our West Bank correspondent Nika Hamed joined us earlier to bring us up to speed on the latest Israeli crimes across the occupied territory. Let's take a listen.
The infantry units, of course, inside Lutsansk refugee camp have made incursions and raids into the neighborhoods of Al-Manshiye and Al-Maslah. Of course, the raids included vandalism, burning down homes, and forcibly displaced Palestinians. Another Palestinian, a 54-year-old Palestinian man from Tulkarem, was hospitalized after being beaten, severely beaten by the IOF forces inside Nur Shams. If we are to go a little bit south over here in Ramallah, a raid have been performed towards the area of Ain Misbah just less than an hour ago, vandalizing Palestinian homes and terrorizing families that were walking into the street. Still is going on was the attack on the Haitian refugee camp in Beit Lahem, where the IOF since the hours of the morning have been raiding at the Haitian refugee camp in Beit Lahem, attacking Palestinians, arresting Palestinians, occupying houses and making them military outposts. Of course, many of our colleagues have been detained and assaulted inside Beit Lahem. Our colleague Muad Amarne, Ayy Ramadan, and Khalid Abu Aisha were all beaten inside the Haitian refugee camp to the east of Al-Quds, many vandalizing, bulldozing houses and farmlands have took place in the hours of the morning, demolishing of many homes to the family of Al-Haydat inside Anaka also took place.
Iran has strongly condemned the racist Israeli regime's continued attacks on Palestinians in Gaza and the occupied West Bank, especially during the Eid al-Fitr holidays. Foreign Ministry spokesman said Israel's crimes included targeted assassinations of journalists, deliberate attacks on medical personnel and healthcare centers, and incursions by extremist settlers into the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Ismail Baghaei urged the UN to end Israel's policy of using starvation and famine as tools of genocide. He criticized the inaction of some Western countries on Israel's violations of international law, calling it a clear sign of their hypocrisy regarding human rights and the rule of law. He called on all nations, especially Islamic countries, to stand in solidarity with the oppressed Palestinian people and stop further massacres of innocent women and children. Italy's foreign minister has responded to points on Israel's genocide in Gaza raised by senators during a question time session in the Italian upper house. Some lawmakers have slammed the Italian government's staunch refusal to condemn the regime and Netanyahu for their heinous crimes in Palestine. Here's more.
On Wednesday, a number of Italian lawmakers pressured Italy's foreign minister Antonio Tajani to finally express words of condemnation for the Israeli regime and Benjamin Netanyahu after 18 months of relentless slaughter in Gaza. Tajani answered questions on Israel's genocidal acts in the Palestine during a question time in the Senate. His words were far from condemnation for Netanyahu's heinous crimes.
Our government's position is clear. Conditions for a political dialogue must be created in order to achieve a two-state solution, but without Hamas. I will reiterate this at tomorrow's EU summit of foreign ministers.
Senza parole, l'ho detto prima.
I'm flabbergasted. Once again, you haven't been able to express a single word of condemnation for Israel's onslaught of more than 50,000 people in Gaza, many of whom are children. Gaza is razed to the ground. Minister, you haven't been able to say a single word on the one responsible for this massacre, war criminal Netanyahu.
Italy's support to Israel's genocidal operations in Gaza has been so far unconditional. In January, the Italian government told Israeli officials that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu would not be arrested under an ICC warrant were he to visit the country. War criminal Netanyahu is slated to pay an official visit to Hungary this week following an invitation from Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán. Some Italian lawmakers have said Hungary should deny entry to Netanyahu or arrest him if he sets foot in the country.
Netanyahu's visit to Hungary is one of the many legs of the Israeli government's macabre tour of Europe. We deem Netanyahu and his government partners bloodthirsty war criminals, And unfortunately, the international community and most Western governments have failed to provide any opposition to Israel at all. We must strongly oppose the Israeli genocide by imposing sanctions on Netanyahu's government, including suspending Israel-EU association agreement.
Former EU High Representative for Foreign Affairs Josep Borrell has often insisted on convening a summit with Israel to discuss violations of human rights obligations under the EU-Israel Association Agreement. However, Borrell's successor Kaya Kallas has so far been much more obliging towards the regime than her predecessor Max Civili Rome.
The Israeli regime has carried out fresh airstrikes on Syria, targeting a defense research center in the northern Damascus, as well as military airports in the central parts.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
According to local media, Israeli warplanes attacked the scientific research center in Barzeh district of Damascus. It had previously been bombed in December 2024. Israeli airstrikes also targeted a military site in the Al-Qutayfa area west of Damascus. The regime also hit the Hama military airport with at least 17 airstrikes and the T4 airbase in Homs province with several raids. At least 15 people have been killed so far as a result of the intense Israeli strikes around Hama. Simultaneous with the airstrikes, Israel's military vehicles started advancing in the area of the Jabalia Dam near the city of Nawa in the Deraa countryside, bombing the area with artillery fire. Israeli forces killed a dozen civilians west of Deraa after its citizens clashed with them. Two Israeli drones were reportedly shot down in the area. Mosques in Deraa called for a general mobilization, urging people to take up arms for resistance against the Israeli incursion. The United States continues with its deadly airstrikes on various areas across Yemen in a bid to force the country to stop its support for the Palestinian people. In their latest aggression, U.S. warplanes conducted an airstrike in the Gaza district in Sana'a governorate, targeting a civilian car. No report on possible casualties yet. The United States also carried out air raids on Saada governorate. According to local sources, American warplanes targeted various areas southeast of Saada city with nearly 20 airstrikes. An airstrike also targeted the Red Isa area or the Ras Isa area in Al-Salif, killing one citizen and wounding another. More American airstrikes targeted Taiz governorate and the communications network in Ib. The air raid on Ib left one civilian dead. Hodeida, the governorate, was also hit with new air raids after an earlier attack on Tuesday struck a water reservoir in the city of Al-Mansouriyah, leaving five people dead and several others injured. The attack also disrupted water services to more than 50,000 civilians. Iranians all over the country are celebrating the ancient tradition of Sizdabedar, or Nature Day, by spending quality time with their loved ones outdoors as the holy month of Ramadan ends with Eid al-Fitr celebrations. Fatima Masumi tells us more.
Sizdabedar, uniquely Iranian, brings families outdoors on the 13th day of Farvardin to enjoy picnics, games and nature. People eat traditional foods, play music and throw sprouted greens into rivers to ward off bad luck. This year, Iran's cherished Nature Day coincides with Eid al-Fitr, the most significant celebration for Muslims worldwide.
Today is Nature Day, the 13th of the new year. Traditionally, we have come out with the whole family to enjoy our time together. We tell jokes, laugh, and try to let go of the challenges and fatigue we faced throughout the year.
Since today was Nature Day, we thought this music would bring harmony to our gathering with friends. We came out to play music so others could enjoy it too.
Marking a rare and meaningful convergence of traditions, Nowruz, the Persian New Year, began with the holy month of Ramadan, intertwining renewal with devotion. As the month of fasting ended, so did Nowruz, and their dual conclusion gave way to two significant celebrations, Eid al-Fitr and Sizdabedar.
Like other Iranians, we spent Nature Day in nature. We enjoy eating traditional foods like kebab.
This year, Nature Day coincided with Eid al-Fitr, which was very special for us Iranians and Muslims worldwide.
We've come here for Nature's Day with our friends to have some fun with volleyball and frisbee and my friend playing sang for us.
Nature Day in Iran is a joyful celebration of nature, family and renewal. People reunite outdoors, embracing fresh energy before returning to work. It's a day of fun, remembrance and appreciation for nature's beauty, filling hearts with joy and spirits with new vitality.
And today marks the conclusion of Nowruz holidays for the Iranian people, a particularly significant Nowruz as it coincided with the ending of the holy month of Ramadan. Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
With that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for listening. Take care and bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
The limelight.
Palestinian children are being robbed of their futures, their bodies, their families, their ability to dream, but still they hold on. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for the second part. Middle East Eye wrote, last month, 14-year-old Mo'in Ghassan Fahed Salahat became the youngest Palestinian held under administrative detention without charge or trial, based on secret evidence that neither he nor his lawyer can see. His detention can be renewed indefinitely. This isn't an exception. It's the rule. From the start of the Second Intifada until 2015 alone, more than 13,000 Palestinian children were arrested by Israeli regime forces. Thousands more are killed. According to Defense for Children International Palestine, at least 2,427 Palestinian children were killed by Israeli regime forces between the Second Intifada and mid-2024, excluding those killed in Gaza after October 7, 2023. The killings span decades, checkpoints, refugee camps and cities. The scale of the violence cannot be dismissed as collateral damage. It is policy, repeated, institutionalized, and refined. The cruelty extends beyond violence. It infects language. In late 2023, during a hostage exchange, Israeli captives were traded for Palestinian prisoners, many of them minors. But the British media, and even The Guardian initially would not call them children. Instead, they were referenced as teens or people aged 18 and younger. Such deliberate euphemisms reflect a quiet erasure. Strip them of childhood and you strip them of sympathy. Strip them of innocence and their cages require no keys. This isn't rhetorical carelessness. It's part of an ideological strategy to recast Palestinian children as threats, not victims. If they aren't children, killing them isn't a crime, and mourning them isn't necessary. This erasure didn't begin yesterday. It's decades old. During the first Intifada in 1987 to 93, children rose with stones in their hands. The Israeli regime response was blunt force doctrine, Yitzhak Rabin. Then the war minister ordered the Zionist regime troops to break their bones, and they did. Footage showed children held down, their arms shattered by rocks in the Zionist regime's hands. This wasn't chaos, it was command. That same logic lives on, no longer with sticks, but with missiles and white phosphorus. The bone breaking has become mass amputation. The aim is the same, to cripple the future. That legacy found one of its clearest symbols in the death of Mohammad Adore. In 2000, at the start of the second Intifada, the 12-year-old crouched beside his father behind a barrel south of Gaza City. His father shielded him with his body, but the boy was hit multiple times by Israeli regime gunfire. He died in his father's arms. The moment was filmed, and the world watched. The Zionist regime denied, spun, blamed, but the truth endured. A child was executed while the world looked on. Then came Fares Odeh. At just 14, he stood alone before an Israeli regime tank, a stone in his hand, his body arched in defiance. Days later, he was shot in the neck and killed near Gaza's Karni crossing. The photo of a boy facing down an army, stone raised in his hand, is etched into Palestinian memory. They killed him, but his image lives on. Indeed, the targeting of children has long been Israeli regime doctrine. From the 1948 Deir Yassin massacre to the 1970 bombing of an Egyptian school in Bahr al-Bagher to the 2006 strike in Lebanon's Ghana, which killed dozens. Even in the moments of supposed calm, the killing continues. In 2015, Israeli settlers firebombed the Dawabsha family home in occupied West Bank. 18-month-old Ali was burnt alive. Later, Israelis danced at a wedding, stabbing a photo of the dead baby in celebration. Today, Israeli regime politicians and rabbis speak of Palestinian children as enemies. A rabbi called for killing them without hesitation. A member of the Knesset declared that every child born in Gaza was already a terrorist. Child killer Netanyahu invoked the biblical tale of Amalek to frame mass death, including the killing of children, as a divine duty. An official with the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child said of the situation in Gaza, "The outrageous death of children is almost historically unique. These are extremely grave violations that we do not often see." But the world has seen, and still, the small bodies pile higher. This is not just genocidal in numbers. It's genocidal in intent. and it doesn't end with killing and maiming. It reaches deeper to memory and imagination. Those who survive are stripped of their childhood, their schools reduced to rubble, their teachers buried beneath chalkboards. More than 80% of Gaza's schools have been damaged or destroyed. Even playgrounds have been flattened, swings twisted into scrap, football fields cratered by missiles, as long as their children, Palestine lives.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Trust in God. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z with me, Sister Zainab, on RB English Radio. So obviously the title for today is Trust in God, and this is a really general title. I'm going to sort of narrow it down a little bit just with a particular example from the life of one of our most famous martyrs who was martyred recently. So I'm referring to His Eminence the Sayyid. And so, for example, people would ask him about a particular statement he would make because he would always promise victory. And then when asked, for example, if one of his family members would ask him, well, why do you always make this statement? And then obviously the Sayyid would respond and just say, well, you know, he was obviously referring to the Quran here. And then he would sort of ask another question, say, well, you know, don't you read the Quran? You know, this is in the Quran. And so obviously he would explain, and this is an explanation for all of us, of course. So obviously we need to have this trust. Whatever it is that is promised to us by Allah, we trust this. And obviously the Sayyid himself would explain this. He would say that obviously as this is in the Quran, and God sort of defends those who believe, and God says that if we support God, God will support us. And this applies across all contexts. This does not just apply in specific scenarios, obviously referring to in the Sayyid speech. This applies across our lives. So when we read, when the Quran tells us that, yes, Allah will support us, if we support Allah, if we are trying to achieve proximity to Allah, then Allah will also support us. And, of course, this is also the idea. We must ask everything of Allah. And in a sense, and the promise also is if we sort out, if we make sure our relationship with Allah is correct, Allah will sort of resolve all these sort of, I call them knots and issues in our life, in this world. Welcome back. This is A to Z on RB English Radio, and obviously I'm talking about trust in God, and I was referring to the example of His Eminence the Sayyid and a particular statement he would make, and he would obviously, as his answer, refer back to the Quran and say that obviously Allah promises to the believers, those people who support Him, that He will support them. And obviously this is this touches on another very important concept, and the Sayyid would also highlight this particular concept. He would say this is certain, and obviously certain is something very particular, and obviously Allah does not make jokes. So the promises that Allah makes in the Quran, these are things we have certainty in. So whatever it is that Allah has said, we will do for us. So this In a sense, this should help us a little bit. I know that I today was thinking about certainty on my way back from uni, for example. And for example, in my situation, there was a particular thing that had not happened, and I was just wondering and thinking to myself, well, obviously, if I had this sort of certainty that obviously the best believers, our martyrs, achieve, then these sorts of doubts and worries would not even enter my mind, would not enter our mind. You know, whatever it is, if whether you're waiting for something, waiting for a response for something, there's an issue in your life that needs to be resolved. Maybe you have an issue, a quarrel with someone in the family, you don't know what to do. But obviously trust in God is something that, again, to some extent, gives us the idea that, no, this is every single thing can be resolved. Some of the things, obviously, we especially ask for help from Allah. There's some little things that, obviously, we need to do. We need to do the striving. But really what I'm saying is that, yeah, certainty. Try and make, think about how you can get to that high level where you achieve certainty in the promise that Allah has given us. So inshallah, that's just a few extra reminders for you, and I look forward to welcoming you back to another episode of A to Z here on RB English Radio, and farewell for today. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
A failure to act on its legal obligations deepens the UK government's complicity in the Zionist regime's violent oppression of the Palestinian people. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, for decades, successive UK governments have held the position that Israel's settlements on occupied Palestinian land are illegal under international law. Despite having this clear legal position, the perfidy and hypocrisy of the UK government is without end. The government has both a moral and a legal duty under international law to prohibit all UK investment and trade with a settlement enterprise of any regime that has transferred its own civilian population into the occupied territories, an activity constituting a grievous breach of the preemptory norms of international law. Since 1967, the Zionist regime has seized thousands of donems of Palestinian land to establish its illegal settlements, part of a long-held strategy to ethnically cleanse Palestinians and hem them into tiny Bantustans. Israel's goal is to annex the West Bank, with as few Palestinians on the land as possible. This long-held policy of maximum Jew minimum Palestinians is being implemented in real time, with 40,000 Palestinians recently having been forcibly displaced from Jenin and last year's erasure of at least 50 entire communities. In establishing illegal settlements, the Israeli regime has created facts on the ground to ensure that a Palestinian state is rendered impossible. Yet despite the UK government acknowledging that these activities threaten peace and the physical viability of a two-state solution, the British toothless government has failed to impose meaningful sanctions while continuing to allow the import and sale of illegal settlement goods. This runs counter to the nation's duty under international law. It is a deliberate choice that has rendered the UK government complicit in Israel's criminality and violent systematic oppression of the Palestinian people. The government has avoided publishing a formal response to the July 2024 findings of the International Court of Justice, which deemed Israel's decades-long occupation to be unlawful and highlighted the global community's responsibility to act accordingly. The UK has a duty to not render aid or assistance to Israel's illegal settlement enterprise and to bring to an end serious breaches of preemptory norms of international law. In refusing to prohibit such activities, the UK regime stands in violation of its obligation to not recognize as legal the situation arising from Israel's unlawful presence in the occupied Palestinian territories. All of this is clearly a violation of the obligations and duties of the 30 states, which could result in the UK being held legally culpable in the Zionist regime's violations. In recent years, the UK government has been given multiple opportunities to impose a ban on the importation of goods from illegal Israeli settlements. But despite rhetorical condemnation, the only practical measures taken have been to exclude these goods from tariff and trade preferences, while advising UK businesses to bear in mind that Israel settlements are illegal under international law. Nothing of substance has been done to uphold the UK's obligations to isolate Israel's illegal settlement enterprise and bring an end to these serious breaches of international law, which, at the bare minimum, should entail a ban on purchases or investments in that enterprise. By allowing the continuation of economic activities, including charitable work with the Zionist regime's illegal settlement enterprise, through a refusal to implement a strict ban, the UK regime is effectively disregarding the ICJ's advice that third states must take steps to prevent trade or investment relations that assist in the maintenance of the illegal situation created by the Zionist regime in the occupied Palestinian territory. Rather outrageously, in a recent session of the Parliamentary Foreign Affairs Committee, Middle East Minister Hamish Falconer acknowledged that products from Israel's illegal settlements are sold in the UK and that it's up to individual businesses to decide whether to stock them. Turning this into an optional choice provides a convenient loophole that shifts the burden of action away from the government and onto individual business and trading entities themselves. This effectively greenlights such economic ties. Without further progress on the matter, including an immediate shift in policy to ban all economic activity involving illegal settlements, the British are complicit as a country in the violent oppression of Palestinians and the occupation of Palestinian land and failing to live up to their obligated duties under international law. The UK should immediately enact a full trade ban and prohibit any economic activities with the Zionist regime's illegal settlements. Should the government continue to evade its duties, then the dozens of MPs who last month issued a letter demanding such a ban must act to bring a private member's bill to this effect, similar to the legislation Ireland is considering. Their devolved assemblies and parliaments in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland should also implement their own bans within their jurisdictions, and local authorities should take steps to implement ethical investment policies to ensure their assets and pension funds are not tied to any illegal settlement enterprises too. Without such a move, the government cannot continue claiming to oppose settlements. The UK government must be consistent in its application and upholding of international law, or else face severe legal consequences for continued their inaction. We may also soon see cases arise where Palestinians living in the UK rightfully take up legal action against businesses and companies that ignore the UK government's advice by continuing their economic activities with illegal settlements, a matter that should be seen as a clear warning to all.
Houthis are the first entity in the history of the world to use anti-ship ballistic missiles ever firing against shipping.
No one has ever used
an anti-ship ballistic missile, certainly against commercial shipping, much less against U.S. Navy ships. If there is an anti-ship ballistic missile launch, this ballistic missile travels at about Mach 5, about 3,000 miles an hour.
How much time is there between a Houthi launch and then it could reach a U.S. ship?
If it's coming toward them, now just put yourself in the seat of the destroyer captain on that ship. He has about 9 to 15 seconds to make a decision that they're going to shoot that down. It's intense.
The U.S. military has also made extensive use of its military bases in West Asia to direct attacks against Yemen. The four major air bases of Al Udeid in Qatar, Al Dhafra in the Emirates, Al Al Salem in Kuwait, and Mawafaq Salti in Jordan are the landing and takeoff sites for F-15 and F-16 fighter bombers, as well as large fleet of U.S. Air Force aerial tankers and AWACS, which have played a significant role in the U.S. military's year-long operation in the Red Sea and Yemen. Although this large naval coalition has not succeeded in achieving all of its predetermined goals, it has played an important role in defending the Zionist entity, and without the direct intervention of the U.S. and its allies, the Zionists would have faced much more severe consequences.
Take an unnecessary step of launching direct attacks on Iran. This is one of these U.S. military fantasies that so many people hold in this country, that, oh man, all we got to do is go drop a few bombs on Iran and that'll teach. And I keep coming back and said, yeah, how's that worked out with the Houthis? You know, we can't even stop the Houthis, and we think we're going to stop Iran by dropping a few bombs. We haven't learned a thing.
In fact, the fact that among the Western countries that are members of the coalition, only the two countries of the U.S. and Britain have directly bombed Yemeni soil once again shows the root of most of the conspiracies against the country and people of Yemen in recent years have originated in Washington, D.C. and London.
The Houthis have locked down the Suez Canal, backed by Iran, for months. They have fired at U.S. Navy warships using anti-ship ballistic missiles, Bill. And what are we doing? Nothing.
This was only a brief description of the unequal conditions of the war between Yemen's Ansarullah and the great Western Zionist coalition in the Red Sea battle, and in a situation where the Yemenis had to simultaneously pursue their three important goals, that is, attacking deep into occupied territories, attacking commercial ships affiliated with the Zionist regime and their escort vessels, and also defending Yemeni soil against heavy air attacks by the United States and the UK. The long years of war with the aggressive Arab coalition led to the growth and prosperity of the local weapons industry of the Yemeni army and popular forces. The experiences of the war against the Saudi Emirati forces, the enemy armed to the teeth, led the Yemenis to design and mass produce weapons tailored to their needs in the field of defense and attack, so that they could be used in the fight against a bigger and more powerful army to defend the oppressed people of Palestine.
It seems to me that they're using more advanced and more lethal weapons than they were in the earlier parts of the operation.
Although many of the targets that were attacked in Saudi Arabia were at distances of less than 500 kilometers, and weapons with a range of nearly 100 kilometers were sufficient to attack Riyadh or Jeddah, the Yemeni army, with foresight and certainty that the next war will be with the U.S. and its illegitimate child, the Zionist regime, acquired a large arsenal of long-range missiles and drones with a range of more than 2,000 kilometers.
Stress of knowing that we are being shot at definitely gives a realism to the whole experience that this is not a normal deployment that we are on.
There are few experts and researchers of political system issues in the world who are unfamiliar with weapons such as the Samad and Quds, and from the port of Eilat in the south to the port of Haifa in the north of occupied territories, there are few settlers that have not tasted the bitter taste of encountering the long-range weapons of the Yemeni army. Zulfaghar, Tufan, the Palestine 1 ballistic missiles, and Quds cruise missiles have been used repeatedly against Eilat port facilities, leaving the port's docks almost deserted and causing heavy economic damage to the Zionist regime. Suicide drones of the Samad and Yafa families have also been used repeatedly in successful attacks on the heart of the occupied territories and the city of Tel Aviv. According to Israeli sources, by the end of July 2024, about 220 Yemeni missiles and drones had been fired at the occupied territories. The real nightmare for the Zionist regime and its boastful air defense came when the Yemeni army began using the Palestine 2 hypersonic missiles, a weapon that, in several firings against the city of Tel Aviv at a range of 2,000 kilometers, managed to bypass all Israeli defense systems.
That's where what's going on in the Red Sea with the Houthis becomes relevant, because the United States there, after almost 6 months of effort, has been unable to open the Red Sea. And we've had an aircraft carrier group. We had our coalition of the willing, the allies. And in fact, on Saturday, the French said, oh, we're out of here. This is too violent. We're not used to this level of violence, and we're not willing to take the risk.
But a major and crucial battle took place at sea. Yemeni fighters had vowed never to allow safe passage to the commercial fleet of the regime and its supporting countries as long as the Israeli aggression against the oppressed people of Gaza continues. The past year may be considered the quietest on the northern Red Sea route to the Gulf of Aden. Dozens of successful attacks on Israeli, American, and European ships allied with the Zionist entity caused many of the world's major shipping companies to stop using the Red Sea trade route for long periods of time.
Houthis have a really strong ideological bias to destroy Israel.
Sure.
And to destroy the United States. They say that's fundamental to their worldview. We should take their word for that and believe them when they say it. And so as a result of the war in Gaza, they have taken action to attack Israel.
With the beginning of the Yemeni attacks, the major shipping giants, including Italian-Swiss company MSC, Maersk of Denmark, Costco from China, and CMA CGM from France, and Hapag-Lloyd from Germany, announced they will no longer operate on the Red Sea route. These five companies together handle more than 67% of maritime transfers. In addition to these companies, Evergreen from Taiwan, One from Japan, HMM from South Korea, Yangming from Taiwan, and Zim from Israel, which are in 6th to 10th place among the largest shipping companies, also announced the suspension of their activities on the Red Sea route. The oil company BP also announced the suspension of its tanker traffic on this route. All of these shipping companies are forced to reroute around the African continent and pass through the Cape of Good Hope for an alternative route, which will increase the duration and cost of the sea voyage many times over. Western sources themselves acknowledge the high volume of missiles and drone attacks by the Yemeni army over the past year.
Ultimately, if it continues, it will lead to higher prices. The ships that, for example, move containers, they've been tied up for longer on these voyages, so the shipping companies are already charging more per day to charter out their boats to move containers, and that will feed through to consumers. That there's no way that this gets absorbed by the supply chain. The best way to stop this becoming a crisis is to pursue diplomacy.
According to statistics published by Western sources, as of October 7th, 2024, and the anniversary of Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, the Yemeni army has used 446 drones, 151 anti-ship ballistic missiles, 12 anti-ship cruise missiles, 10 land attack cruise missiles, 55 long-range suicide boats, and 9 armed combat boats to attack the commercial and military fleet affiliated with the coalition and the Israeli regime. As a result of these attacks, according to the Western side, two cases resulted in the sinking of a commercial ship, one case of seizure and transfer of the ship to the Yemeni coast, 40 cases of severe damage, and 16 cases of unspecified damage to the commercial fleet in the Red Sea, and in 28 cases, the attacks did not result in serious damage to the targeted ships. The Yemeni army has used various weapons in its attacks on the commercial and military fleet of the coalition. The suicide drones that were used for attacks on the occupied territories could also be used to attack ships by changing their role. The Kassif series of suicide drones with a range of over 150 kilometers, the Raqib with a range of over 2,000 kilometers, and the Samad family, whose latest version, the Yafa drone, successfully hit the city of Tel Aviv, were responsible for attacks on hostile ships in the Red Sea as well.
10% of the world's commerce passes within range of their very cheap but deadly one-way drones, a.k.a. flying bombs.
Remotely controlled unmanned vessels were also a very effective weapon against targets even 200 kilometers from the Yemeni coast.
Which really changes the dynamic there, and I think the most recent merchant vessel that was hit and is sinking was hit by an unmanned surface vessel.
During the war with the Saudi coalition, the Yemeni army also managed to target several oil tankers and a Saudi naval Al-Madina-class ship using suicide boats, and in the recent naval battle, numerous images were recorded of Yemeni-guided boats carrying several hundred kilograms of explosives successfully hitting enemy merchant ships. Bahr al-Ahmar, Tankil, and Asif anti-ship ballistic missiles with a range of between 200 and 500 kilometers are one of the most important assets of the Yemeni army, and they are displayed in the parades marking the anniversary of the September Revolution before the recent incidents. According to the admission of U.S. Navy commanders, when Yemeni anti-ship ballistic missiles are fired at them or commercial ships in the Red Sea, they have only 15 seconds from the moment they observe the missile to react and intercept that missile, which has led to many interception failures and missiles hitting their targets.
I don't think it will stop if the Gaza war ends, because now and for the past 20 years, the Houthis say they're at war with America and Israel. I mean, their logo is death to America, death to Israel. And so that's what's at stake, is that the U.S. is forced out of the region. Now there is, you know.
The Americans never imagined that they would one day be challenged in a long-term battle in international waters, even by major military powers such as China and Russia. But Ansarallah's clever strategy greatly undermined the long-held notions of America's invincibility in naval combat. Before the outbreak of the Civil War and the start of the conflict with Saudi Arabia, the Yemenis also possessed the Chinese-made C-801 and Soviet-made P-15 anti-ship cruise missiles, which over time were mass-produced with local versions of these missiles under the names of Al-Mandab and Robayich, respectively, and were also used in the Red Sea battle.
I don't think people really understand just kind of how deadly serious it is what we're doing, and how under threat the ships continue to be. I mean, the Houthis are shooting every day. Our ships remain under threat every day, and we're doing a great job defending ourselves, great job defending the force, but it is relentless.
The West or the Yemenis? Which side was the winner of the Red Sea battle? The Red Sea battle over the past year can perhaps be considered one of the most unequal battles in modern history, and perhaps even in all of history. The difference in firepower and technology available to the two sides was so great that before the start of the naval coalition and the heavy airstrikes by the U.S. and Britain on Yemen, many analysts predicted that the Ansarallah would be able to resist in these conditions and support the people of Gaza for a few weeks. But the Yemenis proved that by accepting the sharp difference in capabilities and all the dangers that were on the way, they could win the battle of wills in the Red Sea. But why do we say the Yemenis won the big Red Sea battle? First off, the Yemenis continued to fire despite months of bombing and so-called precision air and missile attacks by the Western coalition, and in the meantime, we are witnessing that especially the European naval forces that have entered the Red Sea battle have realized their great weaknesses and inability to confront the Yemeni army. From missiles that were not fired from the platform to mistaking friendly drones for enemy ones, and problems in various systems of mostly European ships that have not even participated in a series of serious exercises and maneuvers in years, these were among the issues that, in a case like the Danish Armed Forces, led to the dismissal of several senior military personnel. Over the course of several months, the various countries that had sent their ships to this field had fired so many defensive missiles at Yemeni drones and missiles that their vertical launchers ran out of missiles and were now facing a major problem. They never imagined they would face a situation where their missile reserves would run out against Yemen. Many European ships were forced to retreat either to Djibouti or to the Mediterranean Sea to reload missiles and other necessary items so that they could return to the battlefield once again, which of course gave the Ansarallah a good opportunity to find a gap in the Western fleet's